And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Breon, Executive Vice President of TrueSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, and Andrew Tursky, Senior Equipment Writer for Golf.com as well. Gentlemen, what's up?
Great intro, Timmy B.
There we
what's
go.
Going on, boys?
Did you read that?
No.
You just have that memorized?
Yeah. It's what is this, week 48?
I was going to say, he's been doing these intros here for long enough.
48 reps without missing. Well, I think I missed 1 week. How many weeks have you missed, J-Wall?
Maybe one or two.
Yeah.
I'm not on a Cal Ripken.
Instead of, you know, Tursky wasn't back in the days when we were doing it in cars on sides of roads and in coat closets and things like that. So it was always fun. But yeah, we've got a lot of tour news this week. Hopefully we have events coming up after the Travelers here. There's some
doubtful.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's some news coming out of the tour. There's supposed to be a press release and press conference later on today. We've got a couple players more that have tested positive. So
I mean, they can't just have every tour player get corona.
Yeah, it's right now, and some of the big names are in the mix with this point, with this thing at this point. So
Kepka.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Brooks Cupcake.
What happens here?
Hey, Kepka.
We'll see what happens here. But the event last week, I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch on Sunday, but man, it was a lot of fun. They were making a lot of birdies. It's not a course you can make a lot of birdies.
I love usually that course.
Yeah. It's super tight, you know.
It's not my style, being that it's target golf and I'm pretty erratic off the tee. It's a very difficult track, but I like it. It's beautiful.
Next to Colonial, I would say it's my favorite stop on the tour. And I'm biased. Really? I used to go there every summer as a kid. And
you're saying Colonial's your favorite stop on tour?
Yeah. I love Colonial.
Huh. No comment then.
I love, there aren't a whole lot of golf courses on tour that have history. I think Muirfield's up there as well, and probably in like a top five if we were going to go and do like a power rankings. But yeah, I love Colonial and the history behind it. I'm biased. I'm a Texas guy. But yeah, I've got a little bit of personal history too with Harbortown. It is a great golf course, but it does give you some really unfair bounces from time to time. I mean, it is target golf at its finest, and you really can't bomb it there. Although I thought for sure Bryson was going to just flame out trying to go, you know, all out like he was
the governor
the week before
on for most of the week though.
Yeah, you have to. There's no holes out there where you could even like let it rip.
It's out of bounds.
There are a couple, but yeah, I mean, you're right. You've got to be Jim Furyk, you know, straight off the tee with the type of distance that Bryson's trying to get. So, I mean, he did. He put the governor on a bit, but still really impressive to see him contend.
Webb put on a show. I don't know if you guys saw some of the shots that he hit there coming down the stretch on Sunday. And, you know, when he shapes it right to left, he's about as good there is at shaping shots right to left, and he was hitting some shots that were just.
He had a couple on that par five with the pond on the left. I forget what hole is that.
It's on the back.
Two in a row. He hit that green both times, carving it up around that corner. It's amazing.
Five woods, hitting his five woods up over top, and that was one. That's an older five wood he has in there. I think it's.
He's got some old hybrids in there too. One of the hybrids is shafted with a steel shaft.
Yeah.
So.
So we'll talk about
being,
that
us being
later.
Gearheads, we appreciate that.
We'll talk about that in the pod. We'll get to that. But it was a lot of fun. Did you see the ball striking exhibition from Abraham Answer?
He had a bunch of greens.
Yeah, man. Like
what was it, 65 out of 72?
I wonder how you learned that. But yeah, it was on fire. I mean, that's a golf course that's tough to hit a lot of greens because if you hit your driver crooked, you get it out of play extremely quick. And then obviously the
he's playing
tiny
graphite shafted irons.
Thank you for bringing MCA. That up. That's something that I definitely need to be talked about. He's playing Muir 201s with that Mitsubishi graphite.
MMT.
I think it's MT 105. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, he was in the OTI and then has transitioned into the MMT product. And, you know, Abraham, somebody that's close to us at TrueSpec with TrueSpec's connection with Mira, and it's been great to see his growth as a player. And man, he played so well last week, almost got the W. But you know, exciting week this week. I always like TPC at River Highlands. It's fun golf course. I think that it's got some similarities to other courses with the drivable par four, where water's in play, and it's a fun golf course to watch these guys play. But unfortunately, as we mentioned at the top of the show, there's some concerning news coming out of the tour regarding coronavirus. So hopefully, we get more events after this. But as far as the episode today, we wanted to go into a driver story out of Sergio Garcia, kind of interesting. And then we also wanted to discuss hybrids and break down hybrids out on tour. It seems like they're becoming more prevalent. It's a category of club that you would see very sparingly. And it looks like some of the players of prominence are starting to play these category of clubs a little bit more frequently now. We'll go into a couple of mailbag questions.
We going to get our debate on?
Well, we can. Three-wood versus driver off a tee.
I'm just going to sit back and watch this one. I'm going to be a casual observer.
Get the popcorn, Jay.
You got to have a club in the fight, though.
Yeah. Oh, I do.
Okay. All right.
Whichever one prevents him from hitting it in the woods. That's oh, my God.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Coming in hot today.
Yeah,
can you be?
So, and then we'll get into part two of the Gary McCord interview. There's some stuff on this part of the interview that's pretty wild.
Oh, man, it's
wild.
So good.
You can't miss this one. Part two is incredible.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
He
Make
he
sure you
it
stay around for part two. It is truly gold.
Yeah,
audio
so
gold.
Should be a good episode. And with that, let's get into our first topic, Sergio Garcia's driver, J-Wall. I haven't really heard this story before I walked in this morning. Sounds like he's in a TaylorMade product, and it's a little different than the regular products that are out there in some way.
Yeah.
He was in a TaylorMade product.
Yeah, it wasn't a TaylorMade. Yeah, Tursky wrote the story, so I'm going to let him kind of give the lowdown on this and the differences.
Yeah, so I don't know how we all missed this. I guess 6 months ago, TaylorMade put it up on the USGA conforming list.
6 months ago.
Driver,
let's just say that again.
Six months ago, yeah. January 1st.
We'll spot us 3 months because they weren't really playing. So.
Yeah, it popped up as a sim tour, like quote-unquote tour. So, I mean, you'd assume that, more compact head, deeper, takes spin off, whatever.
Yeah.
So Sergio put that in the bag up until the Players, so he used that throughout the whole year. He said he's since switched to Ping.
Right.
So
it's pretty much Ping throughout the bag, isn't he, man?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know if there's a brand deal cooking there or what.
I think he may have a couple of TaylorMade woods, like a 3 and a 5 wood.
Yeah.
But I know
so
the
we talked
Ping.
To a
he was testing a TR20 driver a couple weeks back.
Yeah, so I pointed that out. There was a video of him.
Yeah, he was testing a TR20 Honda.
Yeah.
Honda
most,
TR20.
Most recently when he teed it up, he had a G410 in the bag, though.
Yep.
But anyway, so for the beginning part of the year, he was playing this TaylorMade prototype tour driver.
Right.
And we talked to a TaylorMade rep the other day, and he was like, literally the only difference in design between the Sim Tour and the Sim is the TaylorMade brand logo, like on the alignment,
on the
line
crown.
On the crown. That's it. It just didn't have that.
It was removed, but because cosmetically it is different than the regular,
they had
sim,
to put it up on
you
the conforming list. Yeah,
that's the thing that people need to realize. When you see a driver on the USGA conforming list, and the conforming list is available to anybody, it's not just something that
right.
Those within the industry get access to. You can go on the USGA's website and search for the new products that have just come out and been approved by the USGA. But seriously, cosmetic changes, they've got to be approved. So they've got to send another driver out. And I'm sure everybody was speculating that it's like a new head, but Butursky's right. Yeah, just the removal of that, a little bit of alignment aid on the top. So
here's what makes no sense to me and what never has. Who just goes on like the USGA conforming list and just looks at all the new entries every day? Like, how do we know?
Only people like us.
Every Monday.
Yeah.
People do that every Monday for real?
No. I mean, I don't think that there are people that actually do that. But
I don't know. Like, people find this information out. Like, Strix on Iron just dropped on the conforming list.
I used to
on a regular basis.
Our line of work is very important.
You used to do that on a regular basis.
So, like,
when I worked for the tour, I did, for sure. When I worked for the tour, like, every time the USGA updated their database that morning, beginning of the week, I was checking it just to see if there was anything there. Now, I don't do it as much anymore. I don't know why. I think I just kind of tired of constantly making that part of my morning to-do list on a Monday. But yeah, I did. I
that's like such a Monday morning disappointment. Like, how often do new clubs hit the conforming list really throughout the year?
Well, so I mean, Shrixon just had some new irons.
About checking it over the last month. And the reason is exactly, Shrixon has a new iron. With new product launches.
We shouldn't say iron singular, but irons plural. It looks like a brand new series of irons. They're, what is it?
Exactly.
ZX7, I think, is what they're calling it, Tim. Or ZX5 and ZX7. Yeah.
Yeah, and they've got a 5, a 7, and there was also a tour blade in there, too.
So there are kind of throughout the year, you might find some diamonds in the rough, or you could find one 6 months too late.
Yeah.
6 months late is serious.
Yeah, that is.
How did everyone miss that? I don't understand.
So the deal is right now is it's actually important for club fitting companies, anybody that's in the retail space, to check those conforming lists, because that's kind of it tips the hand of the manufacturers as far as what's coming.
Yeah.
And right now there's more question marks about what's going to be launched and the cadence of these launches over the next year because of the effect of COVID. So
my prediction is that the Sim Tour driver will never come out. Why would TaylorMade release that without their logo on the crown?
There's no chance that will ever come out. It's a tour player asking for it. It's one of those things where he's high profile enough to where you're going to say yes, and you get it approved, and you don't have to do anything, you know, anything more than a cosmetic change. Don't have to make any adjustments to the design. I mean, that's an easy yes if I'm TaylorMade.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So with that, let's get into our second topic of the week, which is hybrid usage out on tour. And we've seen, you know, going back a few years ago, we had Y.E. Yang, and you know, you had some other players that had quite a few hybrids in play. But for the most part, hybrid usage isn't very prevalent. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, hybrids are innately, usually most of them are innately left biased due to the lie angle, as well as some of the CG properties and offset and various different design features that designers play with.
That's why I'm not on Team Hybrid.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things with a lot of hybrids that will make them a little bit left biased. Now, you do have some hybrids out there which have flatter lie angles that will be used by better players and have more success with. But in the last year, we've seen a lot of marquee players actually transitioning into hybrids. And I know that, Andrew, you thought that they were coming out of the bag, you know, shortly thereafter, and they've stayed in. And we start to see even more players starting to test them and work with them. So
it just smelled fishy. It smelled like a marketing play where it's like, let's get it in the hands of Rory and DJ for a couple of weeks. Let's sell a bunch of hybrids. Then they'll take it out later and say that it's like course dependent. But I guess they really like the hybrids.
Have they developed, speaking of the conforming list, have they developed an actual sim hybrid tour head that has a longer stem hosel that they can bend with? Because I know that was an issue where they were having a tough time bending hosels on those things to get them flatter. And the reason being that they hadn't really game planned to have a tour hybrid. And then all of a sudden a couple guys played them and liked them, but they wanted them a little flatter. So I haven't seen that there's a version of that is for tour players. I think it's still just the retail heads that they're basically using. Am I wrong?
Well, I think that they designed it to be like kind of a tour head where it's like more iron-like, it's more fade biased.
It's slimmer looking in profile. Yeah. And
but in terms of bending it flat, I'm not sure, honestly.
Yeah, so I was looking for that coming out of this story because we were all, you know, aware of the fact that a few of these players started testing these hybrids, but they were testing them with retail heads more or less. And I was curious to see if they would come out with a tour version of it that had a longer stem hosel that was a little more compatible with bending. I haven't seen that yet. So that's kind of interesting to me that we've got players that are playing heads that are fairly close to the retail version, and they haven't gone into a tour-only version. And as you said, you thought they'd come out of the bag, but they've stayed.
I'm surprised. I mean, I just got to eat crow on that one. It's nothing really. You, there's nothing I could do.
Jay Waller, are you a hybrid guy? I can't think you are. With
I'm,
you
I'm
being
not.
A
I,
guy that
I've
hits
been
hooks.
Dry.
He hits it too high.
Yeah.
I've worked on my ball flight a little bit. It's just more than anything. It's not so much technique. It's just lack of practice. And you know, I used to compress the ball a lot better than I do now. And now I just pick it clean. Like I've always joked before, I'm a superintendent's dream. Yeah, I'm not gonna leave the range with nary a blade of grass out of place. So yeah, I can't do the hybrid thing. They spin too much. I've tried, you know, heavier, stiffer shafts. I can't get over the profile. A lot of hybrids to me just visually look shut. And as Tim mentions, yeah, ball flight wise for me, you know, if I'm missing one, it's hooking. So a visually closed club phase is not what you want in a situation like that. So
right.
Yeah, I've always kind of gone towards utility irons and, you know, more game improvement, something there at the top of the set that I can bang out there if I'm not hitting the driver well. But it is kind of cool to see, you know, at least, you know, this is a very a course dependent club for Harbortown, but you've got the guy winning with two hybrids in the bag, one of them with a steel shaft, as we mentioned. And then you've got Dustin Johnson with two hybrids in the bag. You know, before this season, he said he couldn't really remember a time when he had a hybrid. He thought that maybe it was back early on when he started his pro career that he maybe had a hybrid. But to see him have two in the bag, you know, again, he just didn't see the value of having three win in. It just went too far, and it's a target golf course at Harbortown. You want to hit your spot. So it's not something that you're going to see him play for long stretches. But still, as Tim mentioned, you know, hybrids for the big swingers have always been an issue because they have that one miss that a lot of tour pros don't like to see. And Sim Max has been able to kind of eliminate that miss, and that's why you've seen guys like DJ and Rory play it. And I don't know, you know, what it has as far as staying power after this season, but for at least this year, I still think it's a fairly big story.
DJ kind of makes sense to me as a candidate for hybrids because he hits a cut on like every shot now. Right. You know, back in the day, he was hitting a draw. You can't hit a hybrid, but now that he hits the controlled cut, you know, hybrid might be good for him, especially on a course like Harbortown.
When you look at the golf courses they're going to play this year in the majors, and you look at Winged Foot, and you looked at obviously Augusta.
If they play the majors,
yeah, good call. And I can see where, you know, that's usually where having these higher ball flights benefits players, except for the Open Championship over, you know, in the UK. Usually with majors, it's better to flight it higher and bring it in really soft into some of the green setups. So,
where do you rank Winged Foot on U.S. Open courses? Oof.
I mean, it's way up there. It's one of the legendary golf courses in the game. And so much history out there as far as things happening.
You know, I think we can all agree Oakmont's one.
Oakmont's up there.
Shinnecock's two.
Yeah, I'd say Oakmont's one, and
Winged Foot's three.
You mean you're not putting Chambers Bay up there in your top three? No, or Aaron Hills? Aaron Hills?
You're not Aaron Hills guy? I don't know how those even got into this conversation.
Anyway, yeah, sorry I brought it up.
So,
I'm just saying that I think it's top three. I love Winged Foot.
So I'm just gonna say this: if Mr. Tursky can't hit his three iron well on the set of irons we just fit for him, we are going forward with fitting him for a hybrid.
We'll see about that. Anyway, next topic. Anyone who's dealt with erectile dysfunction knows how awkward it can be to talk in person. Luckily, there's a simple, convenient solution to get the treatment you need without leaving the couch. Our friends at Roman have spent years building a digital platform that can connect you with a doctor licensed in your state, all from the comfort of your home. Roman makes it convenient to get the treatment you need right from home. Just grab your phone or computer, complete a free online visit, and you'll hear back from a U.S. licensed physician within 24 hours. And if the doctor decides that treatment is right for you, your medication can be shipped right to your door with free two-day shipping. You also get free unlimited follow-ups with your doctor anytime you have questions or want to adjust your treatment plan. With Roman, there are no commitments and you can cancel anytime. If you're struggling with ED, stay home and go to GetRoman.com/FE for a free online visit and free two-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/FE for a free online visit and free two-day shipping.
Golf is back. That's right. We have a full weekend of golf ahead of us. And even though the trophy is reserved for the winner, the big cash prizes don't have to be. To add to the excitement, DraftKings, the leader in daily fantasy sports, is putting you in the center of the action with a free shot at $1 million in prizes in your first deposit. It's easy to play. Just pick six golfers, stay under the salary cap, and submit your lineup before the tournament tees off on Thursday. Then sit back and follow the action. The more red numbers they have on the leaderboard, the closer you'll be to winning some green. Rack up the points for pars, birdies, finish position, and more. In a time of limited sports, this is your chance to scratch your competition itch and reign supreme. Download the DraftKings app now and use code FE during sign-up. This week, DraftKings is putting you in the action with a free shot at $1 million in prizes. That's code FE, and you can get a free shot at millions of dollars in prizes only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. And with that, let's get into our mailbag for the week. I think we've got a couple questions, Jay Wall, that our listeners submitted.
Okay, we definitely have a couple of good ones this week, and we'll kick it off with this one. First question, I have a fairly steep entry path to the ball and tend to spin my wedges too much. Join the club, man. Other than a change in technique, is there anything gear related that I could do to minimize spin?
Well, number one, I'd play some kind of plated or finished product. I wouldn't play raw. The next thing is I would probably not play anything that had micros on the face. You know, the little micro grooves that are in between each of the main grooves. I probably would go with something that, from a shaft perspective, was not a wedge shaft, so to speak. So you have different shafts out there nowadays, and the wedge flex or wedge specific shafts, usually they are a little bit more flexible in the tip section, which is intended to create more spin and have more activity down in that area of the shaft, which causes spin. So I would play something that is more in line with a regular iron shaft, specifically something that has a little bit stiffer tip section down in the shaft.
A good one, if you're looking for options, that I've tried and had success with was KBS's 610 wedge. Right. Is a good one if you're struggling with too much spin. It's a viable option.
I have a trick.
I have a trick
that I learned from Gary McCord, which you're about to hear on the second part of the
interview. There we go. Just spit on the face of the golf club.
No. You take a practice swing. Yeah. You make sure you take a divot and you leave the dirt in the grooves.
Yeah.
It'll never spin again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go.
Shout out Gary McCord.
Or you take a swing, like if you're in the early morning, you're in the fairway, you take a swing in the rough where it's really wet,
yep.
You just leave the moisture on the face.
Leave the dew on the face. Yeah. That'll take all the spin off too.
There you go. So we all have little tricks. But I would say, you know, between micros on the face, making sure that maybe play a shaft that's more like your irons, Jay Wall. You mentioned the 610 wedge shaft, and you're right, it will tend to eliminate some spin. But almost all wedge-specific shafts are going to spin more than a dedicated iron shaft. So whatever you're playing in your iron set, play it all the way through the wedge. Going with something that's heavier in weight on a wedge shaft would help. So those are all different things that you can explore. And then the other big part here is we're talking about it from the gear perspective, but obviously thinking about this from a technique perspective probably makes sense too. One thing I would be careful of is where you're striking it on the face. So there's been a lot of research by a biomechanist and a couple of really smart people in the instruction world about these guys that create all this crazy spin by striking it off the toe of the club. And the idea being that it kind of deadens the blow. So there's less energy that transfers to the ball. So you have to swing a lot faster to hit it the same distance. And by swinging faster, you generate a lot more spin. You look at like Phil Mickelson, right? And that interview we had with Roger Cleveland, the reason they designed a high toe was to give him a striking surface way up on the toe so it would deaden the hit and he could swing really hard at a lob shot.
You look at Freddie Couples' wedge too, and the wear mark is like way not even on the grooves.
Yeah, it's way out
it's
on the
so
toe.
Far out on the toe.
So the idea here is if you're a guy that's striking it way out on the toe, you're probably going to create more spin because you have to swing so much faster in order to hit the same shot. So maybe you want to try to get your strike point closer to the center of the face and you won't spin it as much because obviously you're going to have to swing a little bit easier to hit it the same distance. And by swinging easier, you won't generate as much spin. So those are a few different ideas, but you know, or the last thing you do is consider a different golf ball. So everybody out there, you know, they fit their golf ball to their driver. What really makes the most sense is fit your golf ball to your wedges and your putter. Those are the ones that you're using the most during the course of the round. So make sure that they fit your wedges and your putter, and you'll probably score a lot better, even if it's not perfectly fit for your driver. So there was another mailbag too, right there, J-Wall?
Yep. We've got another good one, and this is going to bring up a very heated debate, I think. The question is, don't know if this is y'all's wheelhouse, but I'm in an argument with a buddy on whether he should leave driver in the bag and hit 3-wood exclusively. Any thoughts? I guess to further explain, is there a club design aspect like MOI, size of the sweet spot, etc., that would make 3-wood a better option over driver or vice versa?
So I really want to come into this, like I want to get schooled on this, because I've spent 30 years of my life now thinking that driver is more forgiving than a 3-wood. There's less variables because you're not dealing with turf interaction, right? Well, and it spins more, so you're going to hit it
I know this much. Line. Just applying this to my own round of golf on Sunday, I would not have hit a lob wedge 23 times in one round of golf if I'd have hit 3-wood off the tee a few times.
23 is too many times to hit a wedge in one round.
23
hit,
times
hit some more round. Greens there, Tim.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a struggle. So, but I know where you sit. You say hit driver. Just
bigger face, driver. More forgiving. Higher MOI.
For the sake of the argument, I can argue a counterpoint here that's compelling, but I would say in general I do agree with the idea of hitting driver. But
this wasn't even a go. We're all
that was easy.
There is a valid argument on the opposite side that there are some people that probably would benefit from hitting a 3-wood, and who are they? You know, if you think about it, a 3-wood's going to go 20, 30, maybe 35, 40 yards shorter than a driver would for some players, right? And so if I'm hitting it 2 degrees offline to the left and 2 degrees offline to the right with a driver, that cone of dispersion grows as the ball goes further and further out. So with a 3-wood, the idea being that, you know, you're not hitting it as far, so therefore it can get in less trouble. So that's one idea. Does a 3-wood spin more than a driver? Yes, it does. But it also tends to generate more... there's less spin axis tilt on 3-wood shots, especially with gear effect, than you get on driver. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's more loft on the face. And by generating with more loft on the face, you get more spin, which keeps the ball airborne, and it makes the ball not run a lot when it hits. So, you know, somebody that hits a lot of errant shots, you know, now you can make an argument against it with somebody that's hitting it all over the face. If somebody doesn't have a very consistent strike point on the face, they probably want the biggest object possible down there to try to connect with.
Mm-hmm. 3-woods are hard to hit.
Well, for a lot of people, especially off the fairway. So I'll say that much about 3-woods. The average golfer, the vast majority of golfers off the turf, meaning without a tee, probably don't have the skill to consistently use a 3-wood.
But even off the tee, because you're not teeing a 3-wood very high. And if you tee it too high, then
you're
risking going right under it.
Yeah, I mean, and it all depends on the design of the 3-wood. If you're looking at something super shallow, like what the Orlemar Tri-Metals were and what some of the Adams Fairway Woods back in the day were, and you look at some of the shallow faces today, like G410 with Ping, yeah, you better not tee it very high because it's a super shallow face, which is designed to hit the ball up in the air anyways. You look at some of the deeper faces on 3-woods, like Callaway had a Steelhead product out a couple years back. That was an amazing product off the tee, but it wasn't all that good off the fairway. Just because of how deep the face was and
3-deep.
Different properties of CG.
X-Hot 3-deep.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, another argument for 3-woods instead of drivers is that the shaft is a lot shorter, you know, 2 inches shorter. Mm-hmm. So the magnitude of your error tends to be exacerbated when the shaft gets longer and longer and longer.
Yeah.
And so... you know, for some players that may struggle with the length. Now, you could make an argument, why don't you just go to a shorter driver then? Why don't you just go to a 43 and a
which
half?
Which is what people are doing. Guys like Ricky Fowler.
Yeah, so we got some people that are saying, you know what, I still want that enormous club head with maximum margin of error. And let's face it, the driver's designed to flight the furthest as far as launch and spin. But I want to go with a shorter shaft so I can gain the control. Mm-hmm. a lot of players have found that they don't give up a lot of distance. There's like a sweet spot for a lot of players that they get down to a certain length, and they find that they don't really give up much distance, but they gain a lot of accuracy. So there are a few different ways that you can argue for three wood, but I would say in general, for most players, because of the fact that the biggest issue on driver is the consistency of strike location, they're better off probably hitting driver than three wood.
My thought was always like, if I step up on a par four and it's a hard dog leg left and I really want to work it around the corner, I'm going to hit three wood.
Right.
Because I can spin it more.
Well, yeah, it'll have more spin coming off the club head, but a lot of that's going to be spin that's what I would consider. There's no such thing as side spin. It's spin axis on a tilt. But if we were to break the spin down into the different components of spin, it's going to have more backspin compared to the side spin with a three wood in most strikes.
All things being equal, if you hit it, you know, with the same face to path, like everything's equal, a driver's going to draw more than a three wood.
Yeah. You mean face to path, strike location, all of that?
Everything, yeah.
Well, you've got faster speed, so yes. So the magnitude of spin is going to be high, especially if you have any spin axis tilt. So when you have like a spin axis tilt to the ball, you're going to get more magnitude of spin axis tilt on a driver being misstruck than you will necessarily on a three would be.
Even though it's spinning way less.
Yeah, you got to think the ball is moving much faster through the space too. So that's part of the equation. Like how fast is the airflow moving over the ball? So
I still don't know if I believe it.
Hey, you can hook. You can hook a driver and slice a driver. As far as you know, you can hook and slice a driver way more than you can hook and slice a three wood. Hey, he's talking about like really bad
with slicing. With slicing, it does make sense to me. But yeah, I guess with a hook too.
You can hook and slice a driver way more than you can a three wood. You know, think about those vicious snap hooks you get with drivers on like toe strikes with gear effect.
Like pull hook toe.
You don't get that same shot out of a three wood because it has some loft on the face.
Okay.
What if there's somebody out there who's listening to this who's going, yeah, shorter driver. That sounds great. And they're considering going to say like let's say 43 inches. With the driver, what are some things that they need to be aware of? You know, coming from a fitter perspective, what do they need to be aware of when they're cutting down their driver shaft 43 inches?
Just flat out, don't do it because of the fact that the swing weight is going to get so ridiculously light. If you take 2 inches of,
well, you can do it. Just go to someone that knows what they're doing, and how to make the proper swing weight adjustments, get and bend point, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. These are the things that you need to be aware of. Is by cutting it down 2 inches. If you're at 45,
you definitely don't want to play a counterbalanced product. A counterbalanced product is going to lighten the swing weight to begin with, and if we go with a very very short shaft, it's going to make the swing weight incredibly light. The only way that you could play that club is if you ended up making the club head significantly heavier. And when you do that, that's going to make the tip section of the shaft start to be more flexible. So then you have to cut the shaft differently. And you see where one snowball after another. So
you're basically saying you could mangle a shaft doing this if you're not.
Yeah, you're probably going to waste a shaft if you're not quite sure what you're doing. But for the players that want to explore it, you know, go to your PGA professional or club fitter or club builder. And tell them, you know, you wanted to try something and that's a little bit shorter and see if it's better for you. And, you know, maybe they can point you in the right direction to get you into a shaft product that's a little bit shorter so that you can at least test it and see how it works. All the shafts that we offer at TruSpec for, you know, men's regular stiff and X are all 45 inches. And we use a grip that's kind of a non-tapered grip in many respects. So if we want to test somebody a little bit shorter, we can by them just gripping up a little bit on the club. But, you know, it's very, very rare that we see that players are proficient using 45.5 inches and 46 inches. Now, we've mentioned this a few times on the pod, and it does come back to the three wood versus driver discussion. The research that's come out of both Ping and some guys over at TaylorMade shared some information with me last week. As far as the scoring effects of hitting it further versus hitting it straighter. And it seems like the demarcation point for when it's more beneficial to hit it further is 12 yards. If you can pick up 12 yards of distance, your scoring average goes down per round more significantly than hitting it, you know, 20 yards straighter. meaning taking off 10 yards on left.
And why is that? Because 12 yards is about a club.
It's a club. So yeah, having one less club. And when you talk about picking up in the vicinity of 20 yards, it goes down significantly. So if you can have, if you can give somebody two less clubs into the green, their scoring average goes down, you know, significantly. Now, the only argument against that with the driver is if you're hitting three or four shots around where you're taking a penalty shot, mm-hmm, then it probably doesn't benefit you to hit the driver. But as long as you're not taking penalty shots with it, you're probably better off using a driver nowadays.
Quick question. What's a test that you can conduct like by yourself to determine whether you're a driver guy or you should hit the three wood more often?
I would take two sleeves of balls, go out late in the evening so you don't hold anybody up. Hit, you know, all the one numbered balls with your three wood off of a specific hole on your golf course. Try to hit it on a straight hole, a dogleg left and a dogleg right. Mm-hmm. And see what you get just comparing three against three. And obviously, you're going to count all the shots. Just because you may hit one really bad, don't you know, eliminate that from your evaluation.
It's part of it, yeah.
It's part of it, you know. And see what happens. And you may find that the three wood is not as accurate as you think it is. And if you're that guy that doesn't hit the three wood as straight as you want to hit it, then it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to use it. Unless there's a difference in penalty shots, and that's what I would really look at is penalty shots. How many penalty shots are you taking with your driver versus your three wood? And if there's a significant amount more, then you probably want to consider three wood off of more tees or a mini driver.
Or a driving iron. I love the driving iron. When I want to lay up on a hole, it's like if I'm laying up, I might as well lay up.
Yeah.
Let me get the driving iron.
The good old mini driver. You ever try a mini driver, Jay Wall?
Yeah, because I can't hit three wood. So,
see, he's on team driver.
Yeah.
I love it.
Mini drivers are great, especially if you're struggling with a driver. The only issue is a lot of those mini drivers go close to as far as some of the drivers. So you've got a really tight yardage gap up there at the top. So, I guess it really doesn't matter because, I mean, for me, I was using it just as a, you know, fairway finder. So it doesn't really matter if it goes that far, but it's a nice club to have in the bag, especially if you don't mind just having a golf club that just goes off the tee. Cause you can't, I mean, unless you're a really good ball striker, you can't use that thing from the fairway.
Right. And that part of this discussion is, you know, if you were fit for your clubs, is the three wood that you're using, is it fit to use off of tees or is it more fit to use off of fairways?
We did testing on that for Tim and I did for golf's club test. We found,
right,
you know, a handful of fairway woods that were really good off the tee and some that were really good from the fairway. So that's,
it's rare that you have one that's versatile.
And oh, your swing could, it's important.
Your swing could play a role too, right? If you're steeper, very, very, sweeper, 100%. You hit,
it's all about speed, impact point, angle of attack, face to path, the way, you know, I call it somebody's impact recipe. The way that somebody delivers the club to the ball is 100% in the way that that plays into the CG of the club and the shaping of the club and the MOI of the club and the bulge and roll and all the different design elements. The way that somebody delivers it is what makes these products either work or not work, right? Yeah. But I will say this, in general, regardless of how you deliver it, if a product is a product that's really good off the tee but not so much off the fairway, that usually stands for all players. It's not a player dependent thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if a product is really good off the fairway but not that great off the tee box, it'll be that way for most players as well. So you don't see like where something's really good off the tee for one guy but it's really good off the fairway for this guy over here. You don't see a lot of that. But it is very rare that you find a fairway wood, Jay Wall, as you know. That I would say is versatile, where it can be played off the turf and off the tee just as proficiently.
People ask a lot of their three woods.
Why do you think tour players keep fairway woods in the bag longer than almost any other club that's in there? It's because, you know, I remember talking to Rory and I asked him what's the toughest club to remove from the bag, and he said three wood, five wood, no question. Like didn't even take a, you know, chance for him to think about it for a tick. He just fired it off. So, and I've talked to other tour players.
Look at Jay Wall name dropping.
Well,
oh, I was talking.
If you're gonna throw out a name, you might as well throw out a dude with star power. So, I mean, if Rory's having trouble, then you know, maybe you shouldn't be changing.
So me and, part of this conversation that I
so me and Eldrick were talking. Yeah. And,
so there's one more interesting part of this conversation, which is I don't think the average amateur golfer, when they look at three wood, I don't think that they look at three wood as a club that has a terminating yardage, meaning they look at it as a 250 plus club or a 230 plus club or mm-hmm. two whatever plus club.
That's a good point.
Meaning that it's this with a tour player, this is huge. Like they do not want a 250 plus club. They want a 253 club. And if they hit it further than that yardage, or they catch that, you know, that occasional flyer that goes 15 yards further, for them, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, you don't want to be flying greens.
That's why well, that's why DJ that, never played fairways. The mini driver. I mean, Dustin Johnson never so played the mini driver for that reason. Went too far.
And as you guys know, yeah. with the way that the tour is played, a lot of these fairways are cut in a way where they're kind of angled coming off the tee boxes. So, you know, normally the fairway would be shaped for an amateur dead straight, whereas with the tour they may cut them with a tiny bit of an angle there.
And they're hitting three wood for the reason of not for going the reason through,
right so, exactly. Yeah. So if even off the tee boxes, it makes sense that you don't want to go further if you're going into a green. But even off the tee boxes, they're trying to hit it to a specific yardage so that they have a specific club and a specific angle coming into the green in many cases.
Yep.
So if they have something that goes 265 plus, that's actually not a good thing. They want it. A specific number, and I don't think a lot of players with three woods are just trying to make good contact with it. The thought of hitting it like a specific yardage, like you're hitting a wedge, is kind of almost it doesn't even make sense to mm-hmm. them. But I think that's a big difference in the way that tour players play three woods versus amateurs as well.
So tour players don't miss the center of the face, and three woods are kind of scary for people that might top it.
Yeah.
But anyway,
and with that, I think it's time to get into part two of our interview with Gary McCord. We were able to spend some time a couple weeks back with Gary McCord, and this second part of the interview, guys,
it's fire.
Saving the best for last,
is what it is.
Saving the best for last.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably one of the best 10 minutes of interviews that we've had on Fully Equipped. So I hope you all enjoy. Here's part two.
I was going through some photos from your playing career last night, just seeing like what equipment, seeing what equipment you were playing throughout the years. And it seems like you play a lot of different putters. Like you're definitely a putter switcher. Do you keep all those? And what does your club collection look like?
No, yeah. I gave away a lot to junior golf in Scottsdale. I remember one day I looked around. I go, what the hell am I going to do with these? So I called up the junior golf program. They were great. They came with a van. And I don't know how many golf clubs. There had to be 500-700 golf clubs. And wow. I just put them in there. And I put a lot. One day I remember one year I got putting so bad. Andrew McGee, I just remembered this. We had it was a Halloween party. And we're all, you know, just having a good time in the backyard. And I smelled something. I looked over. And Andrew got with the guys and he got a bonfire going in my backyard. And he went into the garage and he took out every putter that was in my garage and he burned it to the ground. Every putter. There must have been 100 putters. And I come out and there's smoke going everywhere and I'm smelling this resin and stuff. And I look over and he is laughing his rear end. I forgot who he was dressed as. But they burned all my putters. And all of them. Every one of them. The only one I had left was in my bag. So I had to start over again. So that's one of the reasons I don't have same putters.
That's pretty amazing, you know. I've heard the story of Cal Kvecchia dragging his putter from Doral to the Honda Classic one year.
I've done that. I've done that too. There's, so, you know, in the old days.
Well, that was what I was going to get into here, is you come from an era on the tour where I'll say that the tour was a lot more colorful than it is nowadays. And you had a lot of interesting characters that did some interesting things back in the 70s and 80s on the PGA Tour. There have to be a couple of equipment stories aside from the burning, the putter bonfire that stick out to you. I'd love to.
I don't know how you could beat that one, but
yeah, right.
It was a putter bonfire. Yeah. Ask Andrew about that. When grips melt and I have rocks in the backyard, it melt and it got all these rocks and it was just this giant 20-foot diameter black thing. I couldn't get rid of it. It was just, and Andrew didn't care. Okay, the equipment stuff. Boy, there was a lot of stuff we used to do in the old days. I remember once, very, very good golfer on the tour, one of the best we've ever had, who hit cuts. You guys have figured this out.
Yep.
And if there was a crosswind, and the crosswind was left to right with the cut, I noticed that every time that there was that wind in a crosswind left to right, he would take his driver and he'd rake it across his face. So
okay.
I go over and he hits his bullet down the left side. Usually his cut would kind of creep to the right a little bit. But when he wiped his face, the driver just bolted and just went a little to the right. He took off all the spin. And so I walked over.
Oh, I know what he's doing. That's amazing.
So I went over and I go, listen, left to righter that's won a lot of majors. I said, what are you doing with that driver? He goes, what do you mean? I go, I notice you wipe it on your face when there's a left to right wind. He goes, oh, I had too much sunscreen on, so I had to get it off. Really? Okay, good. So guys used to load it up all the time, whether it was chapstick that you would rub, Vaseline you'd
That's
rub
awesome.
On, whatever way you could do it, you would do it. That was easy. Another thing we used to do, and I won't name the manufacturer or anything.
Before you get into that, Gary,
yeah.
For all of our listeners out there, if you put chapstick or some kind of petroleum jelly on the face of a driver, it will absolutely take the spin off the driver.
There's yeah, no let's, doubt about let's it. Say that, let's say in those days, well, let's just take a number. Let's say you're at 3,000 RPM, okay, in those days. You would wipe that off and it would take the spin off the ball and you could get it to 2,500 in a yep. second. So if you had wind, you could literally control your spin. So if any kind of wind, you just wipe that thing and go like that. I remember this. I was playing a money game. This is not on the tour. Money game. I'm on the ninth hole at this golf course that I played in Riverside. And I'm playing these guys for money. My Vaseline was a little bitty jar. It was about like that. And I put it in a pocket there. So I was on the tee first, and these guys are still putting out an eight. So I get it in, and I take a big goop of it out like that, and I hold it up where they can't see it, and I wipe it across the face. Well, one guy three putted, another guy was four putting, so I had more time, so I wiped it again. So I get up on the tee, and I nailed it, and the ball went about 40 yards and went right in the ground. I put so much on it, it took all the spin off. That's the last time I did it. Ball went 80 yards. It looked like I topped it, but I didn't. Another thing we used to do, this was interesting. There was a golf club company that if you went into it and you go way back in the back, there was a door, big wooden door. And the knock was this. Two knocks, stop, knock again.
The door would
like that. Like you're going to some sort of medieval castle. And he'd go back and he'd shut the door. And this was the groove guy. I'm talking, this is in the 70s. The groove guy. Okay? Here's the story. So he'd walk in and he had all these wooden hammers. And he had this nest of lead. Remember the lead strips, Tim, that you had, you put on the clubs we used to do? Well, he would put all these together when he get done with the guys' clubs and put them, and he made a nest that was like this, and it was a perfect inset of a sand wedge. And he'd stick it in there, and then he had this wooden thing that he put on the side to hold it in place. And then he goes, do you want them all knocked up? And I go, yeah. And so what he would do, he would take, and he had a chisel that matched the width of every groove. You know, some right. of them were short at the top and yep. bigger at the bottom, whatever. And he'd take, and so the groove as it is, okay, he'd take and he'd knock up the top of that groove.
Okay.
Wow, one hit. So that'd peel off. So literally when he got done, it was like trying to run a golf ball up a shake shingle roof. Got it?
Yeah.
There was resistance 100%. Every foot as it went out. So he hit the wedges like that on my wedge, and he says, okay, go hit some balls with it. So I hit some balls. I was there one day, and I went and played the Sammy Davis tournament in Connecticut. Okay.
How many golf balls did you go through?
Okay. So I get out there. Now, Weathersfield, where we played, the greens old school. So they're tilted from the back to the front. And that was basically for the water to run off. That's how they did it in the old days. So you had to get the ball high above the hole because it would spin a little bit, right? Well, I get on the first hole and I hit this thing and went zoom. It went back about I didn't practice with it. It went back about 40 feet. So as the day wore on, it got worse and more. I kept hitting harder and harder. Yep. So if the pin was in the front, I'd have to throw it to the back and it spin all the way. If the pin was
in the back, you got no prayer.
So I'm walking up the 13th hole. Walking up the 13th hole, and I hit another one. It spun 50 feet back. And I get this arm around me as I'm walking down. And I'm playing with Gene Littler. And Gene's got his arm around me. He goes, Gary, he said, I seen you've been to the Groove Man. And I go, no, Mr. Littler, what are you talking about? He goes, I know. You've been to the Groove Man. And listen to me closely. You need to go to the range and you need to hit balls for a week and dull those things up. He says, you can't do it right. Would you do this 2 days ago? And I went, oh, yeah. And he goes, go hit balls. And I went, I'll never forget that lesson. But they were all doing that kind of stuff. In the old days.
That's amazing.
Yeah, these boys. I remember the same thing was at Cypress Point where they're all tilted, right?
Right.
And you'd spin them, especially that time of the year, wet ball of spin. And Sam Snead told me, he says, Sam always talks with a list.
Yeah.
And he goes, Gary, he says, you make a practice swing and you go deep, take a big divot, and don't brush off the dirt from the grooves. I go, what?
Yep.
He goes, yeah. He says, they fill them up, it won't spin. So,
because out there you don't want it to spin as much.
You don't want it to spin because it'll come off the green. And I'm on the first hole and I drive it down there, and you know that green is tilted. It has to be a 10-degree angle. And I hit a flyer and it went 20 yards over the green. And that was it. I go, Sam sneezing. So and I couldn't control it. So, but all these old guys had all sorts of tricks that they would do. Yep. With their clubs and so forth to try to play the game and make some money. And there wasn't any money at that particular point. It was just like everybody got together, throwing $100 and you go play for that. It was one of those
things. And this was, this was pre-equipment van. So when you wanted an adjustment to your golf club, you went and found a tree root that was, their Mitchell machine. What's a Mitchell machine? Go find a tree root or something to bend a golf club on.
Yeah, you would go. The favorite deal was you'd find asphalt, or you wouldn't find asphalt. You'd find concrete. Okay, asphalt was too bumpy, and you'd put a towel down if I wanted to flatten my club, and you'd give it a violent swing, and then so your arm is your right arm is just going down right on the heel of that thing, and you extend your right arm as soon as you hit it to flatten.
Yep, 100%.
Three hits, right? And the hard thing was to get it upright. You'd have to find a curve.
Yeah, it was very tough.
You have to find a curve. You have to stand on the shaft on one, put the head over the end of the curve, and then whack it as hard as you could to get the thing to go a little more upright. And that's how we did it, because there was no vans out there. You might find a guy somewhere 102 miles from the golf course that had a place in his garage that he'd fix clubs. But he would always screw it up anyway. So you just did it yourself. And there was never any tools or anything. So we just kind of made do. It was kind of fun. Your clubs at the end,
right?
We didn't have any way to even look at the measurement of the loft.
No. You didn't know what they were. Anything.
So I had 5 3-irons in my club at one time because I'm messing with a 5-iron, 4-iron, 3-iron. And I didn't know until you went out and hit balls. And went, well, that one goes farther than the other. I remember one time my 4-iron was going shorter than my 6-iron. So I just did the opposite. I just put my 6-iron as a 4-iron and my 4-iron as a 6-iron. The math.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
are you kidding me?
Yeah, the math got
tough. Oh, my God.
Really tough. Yeah, and because all the shafts were different, too. And the shafts would pick up. Sometimes, you know, you get one that's lively. And I remember that with my six iron, it was lively. And it got up there going, whee! And that's why I changed it. Six iron was a four iron, and the four iron was a six iron. It's all distance.
You can't make this stuff up. You can't make it up. No. But the best part is you guys figured it out. And that's one of the things that's always been interesting to me. You know, I remember spending some time with a Champions Tour player, a really prominent one, one of the leading money winners in Champions Tour player history. And this player does not deliver a putter the way you would ever teach somebody to deliver a putter. They're hitting down, they're adding loft through impact. They're breaking all of the quote unquote rules about putting. And I remember, you know, presenting this player with this information very tentatively because this person had won millions upon millions of dollars in competitive golf, and who am I to judge about the way they putt? And so then I asked a follow-up question. Do you do anything different? Obviously, hitting down with loft is going to cause backspin, which is not ideal for putting. And so the follow-up question was, is do you do anything different when it's uphill or into the grain? And the player said, yeah, I put the ball up in my stance and press my hands forward, which eliminates hitting down with the loft. It makes you hit up with less loft. So intuitively, he just kind of figured it out. And that's been always one of the things that's been interesting to me in working with some of the players that grew up prior to this technology revolution, is the way that their feels and intuitively they kind of fix things and just make things work. I would say that even more so than the average golfer. The average golfer can't quite figure out how to make something work, but the old school tour players, Al Besselink asking me how my lob wedge was one time, asking me why I even played a 60 degree, saying that if I didn't know how to hit a 56 degree straight up in the air like a lob wedge, I didn't have a future in the game. So, you know, people learned how to manipulate clubs and how to manipulate shots.
I mean, that's let me guess your guy, your putter. Okay? Let me guess him. Ready? Billy Casper.
Wasn't Casper. A little more recent than Casper.
Did he grow up in Poana?
He did.
Bingo. Every guy in Poana you have to hit down at it in Poana to get the ball to turn over on top of the seed head. You had to hit down. So every guy that was a down putter, okay, all of them, from Johnny Miller couldn't putt at all, but he had that little short pop stroke. Phil Rogers, Casper, Littler, every guy in Poana had a tap stroke, just like Snedeker does. And if you hit the ball, we did a bunch of studies, and the studies were basically you'd put a line horizontally on the ball, take your camera from the side and Poe, and you'd hit it to see how that line would roll over, right? Not back up, roll over. And the only way to do it was hit it down in the grain. It got in the grain and then shot out with topspin. And that's why everybody hit down on really bad grass. Aoki hit down. He took divots. I repaired a divot, Aoki.
On a putting green.
It was the Players Championship, and it was in Michigan. And he took a divot about that long on a 15 footer, and I had to roll the divot back. I've never seen anything like it. I got laughing at him, and you know, again, they grew up on car ice, so he had to hit down in the green and pop it up. But yeah, you're right. And other guys that came from Florida would always have long strokes that they released a toe so they could get it on top of the grain that way with overspin on. Gary Cokes and all those guys. Everybody had a different stroke from where they came from, basically.
Right.
Speaking of putting, I understand I was reading an interview with Peter Osterhaus, and he was saying one year you won fewest putts on tour. And I guess there's an interesting story about you deliberately missing greens in your last event. I got to ask you about that.
True story. It was Usti, me, and George Archer. The last tournament of the year was Pensacola. And I knew at that particular point my career sucked and it wasn't going anywhere. So this was the only thing literally I was going to win. Okay. I had a lead. a slight lead over George Archer, intimidated enough. And we got in the first tee, and I looked up to George, 6'5", Gilroy, California. I said, George, this is the only thing I'm probably ever going to win on the tour. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to miss every green short. And because then the deal was, and how they measured it, was you had to hit the green, and then the putts started. And I was at 26-8 or 27, whatever it was. And I told my caddy, you give me the front of the green, take 5 yards off. And that's where I was going to hit it. And I missed every green. I missed every green. And I beat George Archer to win the putting title in 1984. I was the best putter on the PGA Tour. And that's basically the only thing I ever did on the tour. And I actually didn't give it my best to do that. But I was very good at hitting the yardage right because I never hit a green. And Usti was laughing his rear end off every time I hit a shot to the green. And then George gave up after about 10 holes. He knew that.
That's amazing.
So he didn't. He was trying to win the tournament or whatever. I don't know. So, yeah, that's true.
Gary, that one's an all-timer right there.
That's phenomenal.
That story for a while. You know, when we're looking at the game and the state of the game right now, Gary, and obviously we're seeing a little glimpse into the future with what Bryson's done, and you mentioned it earlier on the pod. That, you know, you see other players maybe starting to look at that and maybe mimicking what he's done. Is that what you think? Is that where this whole thing goes?
We're copycat.
As far as, similar to copycat to what Bryson's doing, where you think guys are going to get. I mean, we saw Gary Woodland where he lost a bunch of weight, try to get more mobile, but you see it going the other way where guys are going to try to start getting it further and further and further.
Yeah, Woodland
gained that distance advantage.
Yeah, and the deal there is Woodland had the yardage.
Right.
He doesn't worry about the yardage. He's already got it. He's got that gear. So he's just trying to get through this 13 in a row that they're playing. Okay?
Right.
Because this whole tour has been mashed into a very, very short period.
13-week schedule. It's crazy.
Yeah, so he and Phil and all these guys that have the length are going to get slimmer and faster. Take all the hit off their knees and walk in and doing all that stuff and see if they can play 5 or 6 in a row, which most of the guys play 3 in a row, take 2 off. They're not going to do that this year. So that's a whole different mindset, I think, especially for this year, which is condensed. So it's now fitness. And Bryson's only, 26 now. And he and George Roscoff, biomechanic guy or his muscle activation guy. They've got this. I remember Bryson, we were coming from who knows where back to Denver. And I go to Denver and then I drive up to where I live up towards Vail. And so Bryson, we're on the same flight. So he, as he has a want to do, he manipulates and gets a seat next to me. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever sat with Bryson for more than 4 minutes. But he will confound you in 4 minutes. And I'm on a 4-hour flight with him. And I, so what are you doing? What are you going to Denver for? Well, I've got this guy that's a muscle activation guy. Well, what's that? Now, this was 4 years ago, maybe 5 years. And he's talking about what they're doing. So what are you doing? He goes, well, he says, we're finding that. The muscles and the ligaments and the tendons, which attach the muscles. And then I'm looking for my points of flexion. So I'm coming down and, this is flexing this way. And in the golf swing, it rotates that way. So you find the stress points there, and then you develop them on the other side to counter that, to get stronger. Yep. And I said, so what's the process? He said, well, I will go out and with Greg in Denver, and I'll hit balls. I've got nets. I've got all this equipment. I'll hit balls for about 14 hours, and then we'll go through the month. I said, well, excuse me, what?
14 hours.
I go, what? How many? He goes, well, I'll go for 14. Do you stop? He said, every once in a while, I'll get something to drink or eat. But we go 14 hours, and then we start with the muscle activation. We start finding the biomechanics of the movement and then taking the opposite side and making those stronger. So that flexion part of it is going to double in strength. And
right.
Now, this was for 5 hours. I'm listening to this on this flight. I'm going, oh, God. So I pretend to go to sleep after about an hour and a half. I just, you know, hold on. I got to go to sleep. And he went to Greg a lot to do that. And they decided now that, you know, Bryson said, okay, I need to go. I need to get about, he was at 195. So he said, I'm going to try to get to 235, 240. And do all the stuff I'm doing and stay flexible. And now we're seeing that it works. And if it works, Greg is going to get a lot of business. And all these guys are going to have to get bigger shirts and bigger pants and everything else, because the ball's going to go boom here in a little bit, because this kid's good to begin with. And now if you give him 340 off the tee every time and pretty straight, they're going to have a tough go at this.
Yep. And it's interesting because everything that we're seeing right now, the fruits of his labor, this labor stretches back 18 months to where he started really working on his physio to start to gain weight and gain speed. But the interesting thing here, Gary, is on the gear front, the gear that he's playing is very, very different. Number one, he's playing unilength irons, right? And as we mentioned at the beginning of the pod, I think you're more well-versed when it comes to equipment and gear and understanding the nuance of some of this stuff and a lot of the technical aspects of golf gear. Unilength irons, like that was something that people on tour haven't really given an honest shot. And what went into designing a set of club heads that can be played at unilength. Now he's playing a 5.5-degree driver. He's playing carbon fiber shafts through his entire bag, and the graphite shafts that he has in his irons are way stiffer than you could ever imagine steel being. So he's very different than a lot of tour players. As you know, tour players are very driven by look and feel and aesthetics and, you know, those types of things. He really doesn't care at all about look and aesthetics. It's a little bit about feel. It's all about stability. And now it makes sense why he's been gravitating towards products that have maximum stability. Well, when he's swinging at the speeds that he's now swinging, he needs it. So kind of interesting to see that evolution. As we're starting to wrap up the pod here, Gary, you played a lot of amateur golfers. You mentioned it earlier that the amateur golf and professional golf are a completely different animal. And when you watch the amateur golfer that tends to follow some of the trends out on tour, what would be the one piece of advice you would give your average amateur golfer out there as it relates to his gear and how to enjoy the game more?
Gear-wise, it's so individual. With the guys, I mean, a good fitting, if you get to a point where you want to go play semi-decent golf, you got to go get some clubs that are kind of in the realm of your biomechanics, meaning spin rate, speed of the golf club. Okay, speed of the golf club. If you swing faster, you can play with more loft, you get more spin, you can stop the ball and control the distance. Fantastic. You know, it's golf ball. All these things are involved with this formula. That's why the damn game's so hard. I think if there was one thing I would give them is to know where your club face is. And that's hard. I mean, it's really hard. There's a face of the club, and it travels through time and space on an arc. And you've got to know where it is the whole time. Otherwise, it's going to go off on every direction known to man. And if you can just figure out any way to control where the face is, and there's no, I can give you 100 different ways to control the club face. But if you can do that, you can get pretty good, because what that does, once you control the club face and all the variables, basically like Bryson. Bryson came out, you were talking about, he got a set of clubs that he thought he could reduce the variables, meaning posture. If every club's the same, I stand up to the ball every time. The same.
Right.
Okay. Now I move the thing 11 degrees upright. Okay. It's only one way I can stand. That's kind of over it. My arms out straight. Boom. Variables out. Big grip. Bigger the grip, less hand action you're going to have. Reduce the hand action. Perfect. Done. So what he did was step by step go through and reduce all the variables. And now what's the last thing? Put power to the machine. Just like the robot, put power to the machine. The robot swings the same way every time. All you got to do is jack it up, jack it up, jack it up. And then how much force can you put on that club through the speed of the golf swing? And that's what he's doing. And he took his robot, and all he did was put more amps in it. And he got bigger, a bigger robot, and now he's a big robot. And that's kind of the way, if you reverse engineered it, that's the way the amateur should do it. First of all, you find out, get all the variables and find out where the club face is. So you either hit a cut or a hook, one of the two, but don't hit both. And that's it. That's the basics of it.
Mm-hmm. That's good what I got going there, on right now, cuts and hooks.
Yeah, I mean, and there's no way to play the game if you can't. Every tour player's got a go-to shot. If all hell breaks loose. I won a golf tournament once, and obviously there are very few. I won the Queen Mary Long Beach Open, and I beat a field. I had a pretty good field. The last five holes, I rolled the ball along the ground. I didn't get it in the air. If I got it in the air, it was going to go crooked. So if it was 140 yards, I took out a 3-iron and I rolled it on the green. And I played the last five holes rolling the ball and won the golf tournament. I had nothing left, but I had a go-to shot. Hit it along the ground and let it scurry. There were no bunkers in front of us, an old golf course. And I rolled it. And I won the tournament. That taught me so much because it really doesn't matter. But if you just get the job done, it's not pretty. Now, I'm not going to beat anybody rolling the ball at that level, the tour level. But when you're playing a state open or something, you can do that. Again, you just go with what you got. And if you got nothing, figure out how to beat them with nothing.
That's some genius course management right there.
It'd roll it. If it went in the air, it was going crooked.
when in doubt, roll it.
Yeah, roll it.
So, in closing here, Gary, you brought a little toy into my office a few months back. It was a driver, and it was billed as the highest COR, highest MOI driver ever created. Tell us a little bit about that, because that thing really captured my imagination. We hit a few in the bay. It was a lot of fun. It was very, very loud, I'll say that.
Oh, that was the torpedo, yeah.
Yeah, the torpedo.
I got a hell of a team together and convinced them that we're going to build a driver that my boys can get out there, regardless whether it's legal or not, because they don't care. So I went into production with literally two of the top guys in the field of golf in building a company and building drivers, the best drivers in the world. And I said, boys, there is no limits to what we can do because it's illegal. So how would you build something illegal that will go farther? And we went through so many iterations of this driver, and we came out with that driver you saw, which is 750 cc's. It is conical in shape. The club face on it is the size of a frisbee. And we went through different points of location of the shaft. If the shaft, yep. No rules, and the shaft has to go in the end of the club. Well, what if you stuck it towards the middle of the club like you do with face balance putters that have less MOI, right? Well, you can put it in the middle, but you're going to reduce torque. Torque is distance. Uh-oh, that didn't work. We went through all sorts of things. And we came out with this, and we didn't put any right glue in it. That's why the sound. Because I remember when we hit the bay, decibels. I said, "Boys, you're not going to leave this sound." And when I hit it, you guys, both of you, grabbed your ears and went, "Oh my God!" I said, "Well, the
sound." Kirsty, it's like 140 decibels. It's unbelievable. You've never heard
it. Oh my God!
When I went to the range and hit it, everyone stopped.
Of course.
The hell? That. And the idea, again, is sound connotates distance. The louder it is, the farther it's supposed to go. So if these guys heard that, they would go by it because it's louder than everybody else's. That means it goes farther. It was all part of the marketing and everything else. And then we never did get it off the ground. We had a good time testing it against other drivers to see what we could do. The problem was, in essence, the average club head speed of what do we got? We got 25 million that play golf at least once a year, I think, the National Golf Association Foundation. The average speed is, take a guess, of all those golfers that play golf.
Oh, wow. I'm going to say we're talking driver speed.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it's in the
92.
Upper 80, low 90s.
84.
I'm saying 92. 84.
84. Yeah, that's not surprising.
Now, when you got 84 miles an hour club hit speed average, and that's what I'm trying to build something for that guy to hit it farther. At 84, the only thing you can do is put loft on it to get the ball in the air because they can't get in the air at 84 miles an hour. So the driver, we ran the core, as you know, the core then was 0.83, meaning that if you have a collision with a golf ball and a club, the ball can't come off at 100% of that collision. It can only come off at 83% of that collision. Okay?
Right.
So we didn't care. So we ran it to 90. We got it to 90, the core.
0.90 COR.
Which basically, go jump on a trampoline, okay? And go wee up in the air. That's what we wanted to get. It did no good at 84 miles an hour.
Yeah. Then
we couldn't come up with anything other than to put a valve in there, an explosive device behind the valve, and shoot that thing with it. Or we could get Elon Musk some sort of retro rockets that he's going to put on the new Roadster, Tesla Roadster, to make it go 0 to 60 in 1 second. You could do that, but there we got weight. So anyway, long story short, you saw the driver. You would have to hit it if you looked at it. You'd go, oh, I got to hit
it's
this.
It's wild.
Thing. It's wild looking. It is wild looking.
We'll have to share some pictures on our fully equipped social channels if you don't mind, Gary, because it is very different than what anybody's golfers have seen before.
Yeah, it is really interesting to the process of getting it tested by the top testing guy in the world who is in for all the golf club manufacturers. It's in San Diego, a good buddy of mine. If we'd go out and test that, it was hilarious. Wild. But it helped for somebody to hit a long way. I had Sedlowski hit it a couple times.
Yeah,
you want to talk about a sound?
No, I bet. Oh my goodness. Probably 190 decibels with them.
Yeah, but he hit it like a 9-iron. He'd go up and the spin rate on it was, you ready? 5,600.
Not surprising. And so that's the issue here. When you see the design, Andrew, you know, they've built this very conical shape towards the trailing edge in order to get the MOI way, way up. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in doing so, they've created a mass property that, yes, the ball takes off crazy fast. And yes, it's incredibly stable all over the face, but the ball takes off incredibly high because of all the lead deflection that gets in the shaft. And so what ends up happening is the ball takes off very fast, but very high with a lot of spin.
What were you calling the driver? What was it called?
Oh man, I've got it. We had another company do the same thing. What was that thing going to be called? I took forever. Let's see. Hold it. It was a song by X Ambassadors. That I got the name of it, and I asked them if I could use the line. Let's see, it was something about it's time to break the rules, and that was going to be to drag that line out of it. I forgot what I named the damn thing. You know what we're going to do though, Tim? Which I found out enough. If we have no control over what's going on, you know what you do to take all the spin off? You in the face you create on the top of it. You create an arc or a bubble.
Right.
And that'll take all the spin off something's deflecting and opening as you're going through time and face to face. Well, I'll just put a big, like a cylinder on top. So you hit a certain way, it takes off. Woo! And it takes all that spin off.
It makes sense, actually. You change. Mm-hmm. You're talking about changing the bulge and roll characteristics kind of on the face. Yeah.
Yes.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Gary, this has been outstanding, man. We can't thank you enough for being on the pod. I think all of our listeners out there, I know it's been a ton of fun for me. I hope it has been for them. And we look forward to having you back on the pod again here soon. Enjoy the summer up in Colorado. And we look forward to seeing you in one of our True Specs when you get back in town in Scottsdale.
Perfect. Hopefully I'll have that clip of me and Sasquatch and wishing each other luck for the summer. once we make contact. So off today, actually, this afternoon to go find the hairy beast. It should be fun.
So for our listeners out there, before we started to record on the pod today, Gary confided that he is spending his summer searching for Sasquatch up in Colorado. His goal was to take a selfie. So everybody stay tuned. We'll see how that works out.
Yes. See if I'm around the next time. You What happened to Gary? I don't know. He went up there in the mountains, never came back. Oh, God.
Unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Gary, thank you so much, man. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for being on Fully Equipped.
All right, guys. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Gary.
And many thanks to Gary McCord for part two of that interview. If you're looking for more gear content, make sure to pick us up on our social feeds. You can look us up on Instagram at FullyEquippedGolf, and you can find us on Twitter at Fully_Equipped. See you next week.